If you're here for the first time, you're here for the last Sunday of a series that we have been in, coming out of my sabbatical this summer, in which it started with a trek to the base camp of Everest. And I want to close today, as we've been thinking about a series called Finding Your Mountain, about karma and prayer and rituals. One thing you find when you're hiking in the Himalayas is the influence of karma in the culture. My first morning on the trek, so we hiked the day we got there, spent our night at a lodge, got up early the next morning. I went to the dining room to journal and hopefully get a cup of hot tea, but no one was there yet. In fact, the lights weren't even turned on, so I sat by a window for some daylight and started journaling. And in walked this old man I had hoped was going to be somebody to start some hot water. But instead, he was holding this chain, and at the bottom of it was a pot, and it has something burning in it. And he didn't pay any attention to me. He just walked slowly through the room, swinging it like a Catholic priest with a censer. And the smoke was coming out into the room. It smelled kind of like burning pine. And then he walked out of the room. I asked our Sherpa guide later in the day about that, and he said, he was bringing good karma to the room. Also, as I've pointed out in this series, on the hiking trail, you pass a lot of Buddhist memorials. They're called stupas. Some of them look like tablets of stones called mani stones that have prayers etched into them, and all of these memorials are right in the middle of the trail, so the path goes around them. And I noticed our guides always walk the left side so that the memorial, the religious object, is on your right side. This is true whenever we pass prayer wheels, again, cylinders with prayers written on them that you spin when you pass them. And I noticed our guides always went on the left. They would spin the prayer wheels that turned to the right. Here's a picture of me following our guide. And whenever they go a full revolution, you hear the bell ring. Now, this is done because it's believed that all of these actions generate good karma. So what is karma? What do we mean by karma? You could define karma this way: as the life force, the energy or life force we produce by our behaviors and actions that determines what happens to us later on. And karma is not reduced to just religious practices. It has very much to do with the way you treat people. When you show respect to people, when you treat them with compassion, you generate good karma that will be a reward to you later in this life or another life. The converse is true as well. When you do bad things, when you're disrespectful, well, you generate bad karma, and that will catch up to you. Now, some Christians are really critical of religions like Buddhism and many of the Eastern religions because they say that's all superstition. We don't believe that. We don't believe in things like karma. But if you think about what karma is about, you realize there are some strong similarities between karma and what we believe as Christians. So here's what I want to do in the message, and then we're going to celebrate Holy Communion. I want to talk about what is common between karma and Christianity, and then I want to think about what's distinct about our Christian faith, and I want to end with what Buddhism can teach us about how to take our faith more seriously and about how to make our faith relevant in our lives every day. So let's start with what karma and Christianity have in common. One thing is this: karma teaches personal empowerment. Personal empowerment. Or in a more modern parlance, karma teaches personal agency. That we have the power to make decisions that determine our destiny. We have that power. Tina Turner found the courage in her Buddhist faith to take charge of her life and get out of an abusive marriage. She found that empowerment. Now, we as Christians, and especially especially as United Methodist Christians, believe something very similar. We call it free will. We believe God gives us free will to make choices in our lives, to cooperate with God. We have power to do things that very much determine outcomes in our lives. God gives us that freedom. So there's a lot of similarity there. Something else karma teaches is that you reap what you sow. It's not just the belief that our choices matter, but that our choices also have consequences. When you do good things, it will produce good things in your life. When you do bad things, it will cause bad things in your life. Now think about what some of our scriptures say. In the Old Testament, book of Ecclesiastes, the good you do will come back to you. That's karma. The Apostle Paul said, you reap whatever you sow. If you sow to your own flesh, you will reap corruption from the flesh. But if you sow to the Spirit, you will reap eternal life from the Spirit. Can you see the similarity there with karma? And then a third understanding of karma is that the goal of life is no more suffering. The goal of life is no more suffering. Now, Buddhists and Christians believe very different things about suffering. The Buddha believed that suffering comes from attachments, being too attached to things, so that when we can't have those things, it causes a suffering in our lives. So the goal of karma is that with each life, you get to a better place with more detachment. So eventually, you end up in nirvana, which is complete enlightenment. And the belief is that enlightenment is a place where there's no more suffering. Now, we might believe different things about suffering, but Christians also hold in common a belief that our lives and this world is going in a direction where one day God will recreate heaven and earth. And what will that place be like? The book of Revelation says it will be a place where there is no more suffering. Tears. Book of Revelation, no more tears, which is no more suffering. It will be a place free of suffering. That's what perfection looks like. But this brings us up to a very critical distinction to be made of what separates us and what makes us different in our Christian faith. And that is this: we are not alone in bringing those things about. It is not life. It's not just about the sum of our good or bad choices. We believe that God is very much involved in our lives, that there is a God who rules over everything, and that that God cares about us personally, and that that God can be personally known. Now, that is a very big distinction. When the Apostle Paul wrote to the Colossians, he was writing to people who were influenced by multi-religious beliefs and practices. And in distinguishing what makes this Christian faith unique and distinctive, Paul was saying this God we worship can be personally known in Jesus Christ. So, Paul says to them in the passage which you heard a moment ago, Jesus is the image of the invisible God. God is invisible. God can't be known until you look at Jesus. There's a story about a girl in art class. She was about to start drawing, and her teacher walked by her desk and said, what are you going to draw? And she said, I'm going to draw a picture of God. And the teacher said, nobody knows what God looks like. And with all confidence, the girl looked up at her and said, they will in 5 minutes. Well, you know, we can know what God looks like. God looks like Jesus. In fact, I want you just to exhale for a moment. And I want you to look at some pictures on the screen. Pictures of Jesus. And think about what these pictures make you think of. Maybe Jesus as a source of joy, a source of peace, a Jesus who looks right at you to say, you are known, you are noticed by God. Maybe you think of Jesus' love for the children and how Jesus loves all of us as little children, that Jesus cares for us. Maybe you think of Jesus as the good shepherd who goes and rescues the lost sheep, who cares when we get into trouble, who comes looking for us. Maybe you think about the fact that Jesus probably looked much more Middle Eastern than he did European. And if you think about Jesus' skin color, it was probably a lot more black than it was white. In other words, when we think of Jesus, we think of a God who wants all people to know that they are known by God, who is willing to identify and relate to every person on earth. That this God comes to let all people know that they matter to God, and that every person is worth this God dying for. And that by rising from death, Jesus did so that people would know that life is bigger and life is more than any individual moment. So the Apostle Paul has us think about how big a deal is this belief? How significant is it? He goes on to say, Christ is before all things, and in him all things hold together. In other words, life is held together not by our ability to hold it together. It is held together by a God who holds us. In him, all things hold together. There's a line in William Butler Yeats' poem, The Second Coming, in which he said, widening, widening in the circling gyre, things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Things that circle around a center can eventually get so far away from that center that it begins to fall apart. My friend Jim Harness is a retired Methodist pastor. In one of his books, he reflected on this line from Yeats' poem, and he said it made him think about when he was a kid and he had 33 and 45 RPM records. Anybody remember records? You remember putting a record on a record player? That's how you listen to music. This is before cassette tapes and iPods. You got the record player out, you put the record on the player, you got it centered on the device that held it, you put the needle on it. And Jim Harness says what confounded him was, why did the big records have the little hole in the middle? And why did the little records have the big hole in the middle? Anyway, he had gotten a one-song record, which meant it was the little 33 RPM, of his favorite singer, Ricky Nelson. And he went home with his friend to listen to Ricky Nelson, but it was a little one, and the only record player his friend had the tiny spindle. Well, what are you going to do? He said, I'm going to line it up. And he put it on the record player so that it would line up just right and keep circling just right, and then he put the needle on. This is what he said about that. Ricky sounded fine for the first few bars. Then the record started to slide. The needle began to wobble, and the whole thing slid all over the place. I'd never heard of William Butler Yeats, but I discovered what it means to say things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Life needs a center. All of our lives need a center. And when we are the center of our lives, maybe things will work for a while. Maybe there'll be some pretty good harmony until something happens to us or until our determination wears out and things will slide and begin to wobble. We all need a center that will hold us together. And Paul says the center that holds us together is Jesus Christ. We must keep him at the center. How do we do that? This is where I believe Buddhists can teach us a thing or two as Christians. I believe Buddhists can help us with how to make our lives more relevant. Because one of the things you take away from Buddhism is how they are full of rituals and practices that shape who they are. On many of the stupas I mentioned on the trail in the Himalayas, you see what are called the eyes of Buddha. The eyes of Buddha, that you are being watched. I asked my guide about this, and he explained, he said, that's not like a judgment that, you know, the Buddha's looking at you and gonna get you if you mess up. He explained it this way. He said, the eyes of Buddha represent the truth we know about ourselves. If we lie, well, we know we're lying. We have to live with that. The eyes are meant to help us think about who we are and what we're becoming. Rituals and traditions that you're surrounded with to help you think about who you are and who you are becoming. You know, I hear from many people who visit Nepal and especially get up into the high country and get around the Sherpa people who say things like this. I know that Buddhists are not Christians. I understand that. But I also notice that these people are so kind and humble and compassionate and serving. They act a lot more Christian than most Christians I know. They have practices that help them think about who they are and who they're becoming. I don't believe that genuine faith in Jesus Christ should make us more judgmental or should make us so convicted in our faith that it begins to harm relationships we're in. I don't believe that's the faith that really looks like Jesus. So what can Buddhists do to help us think about connecting with Christ in a way that holds his character at the center of our living? Think about prayer flags for a moment. Everywhere you go in Nepal, you see prayer flags. And they're probably a little misnamed because this does not symbolize prayers lifted up to a god. First of all of the flags have five main colors that are symbols of elements in the world. Yellow is earth. Blue is sky and space. Green is water. Red is fire. White is wind and air. And then written on the flags, what we call prayers, are really blessings that have to do with peace, compassion, wisdom, and strength. So the idea is that when the wind blows the flags and the flags flutter, that the wind is passing on these elements across the earth to other people. Now, that's probably different than we would think when we think about prayer. But how can we adopt that symbol to something we can use? What if we all had our own prayer flags, and on each flag we wrote one word that we believe fits the character of Jesus Christ? What would be your words? Compassion, maybe? Love? Forgiveness? Holiness? Faithfulness? I mean, what are all the words that you would put down? What if you created a prayer flag and every day you took one flag and you thought about what does it mean to live with that character of Jesus alive inside of you? I mean, if you did this practice and you kept repeating the cycle, let's say you had 10 flags, 10 words, and every 10 days you did it over and over again. The one ask I would make is that you don't pray about the words as if it's something you don't already have. Lord, make me more compassionate. Lord, make me a loving person. That has a funny way of telling yourself, I'm not loving. I'm not compassionate. Try turning it around and saying, Lord, I am a person of compassion. And show me ways that I can let that out today. Lord, you have given me forgiveness. Use me today to forgive other people. Lord, I am full of compassion. I am full of love. I have mercy. Show me ways that I can show it today. See what it does in keeping Christ at the center. Go back to the idea of incense. This wasn't just in like the lodges we stayed in. This is a picture of an incense burner outside of a home that we walked past. Lots of people would do this. In the morning, they put the incense burner at the house. They burned the incense. What would that look like in our lives if every day maybe we burned incense in the morning? We lit a candle maybe. And we just said, Lord, this candle symbolizes you are in this house right now. You are with me right now. You are alive and you are at work right now. I don't need to fret today. I don't need to keep saying, oh God, you must get in this situation. I'm going to believe you're already in the situation, regardless of whether I see it or not. Give me confidence and conviction that I can have peace knowing you're present. You probably see where I want to end this message. That this is the mountain. This is the mountain. Who we are. And what we're becoming. The mountain is not getting to a place that's going to give us the happiness we're looking for because we don't have it now. The mountain is not waiting until we receive something we don't already have. The mountain is being who we are and who we want to become, letting it show. The first week, I mentioned this little book, The Zen of Climbing. It's written by a guy named Francis Cenzaro, and I got this while I was in Colorado, read it during sabbatical. He's a PhD scholar from Syracuse University who is also an accomplished rock climber. And throughout this book is this very simple idea that what gets in the way of a lot of rock climbers is they're too focused on the summit. They're too focused on their performance and how well they do instead of just enjoying the art of climbing, getting on the rock and going, this is what I love, instead of focusing on where it's going to get me. I mean, that's the simple idea. This is what he said is the Zen of climbing. Well, we Christians can buy into that. That what God wants for all of us is to find that the journey is about the journey itself, not the arrival, not where we end up. It's not about getting something we don't have, something given to us that we don't possess. It's about what we do with our lives. It's about what we can give. I saw a commercial some years back that I think demonstrates this thought pretty well. Take a look at this.
I think I found my dream car.
It turns out they want me to start next month. She can stay with you to finish her senior year?
Of course she can.
Hey, wanna drive?
Really?
Do you think we can do this, Robin?
Things will be tight, but we can make this work.
That's great.
Okay.
Here we go.
Now.
Wait, Grandpa, what about your dream car?
This is my dream now.
I love that. This is my dream now. This is my dream. This is my mountain. It's not getting to some place where we get what we think is going to give us joy, lasting reward. It's about what we can give. It's about what we can do with our lives. That is what I call good karma.